Hello out there. Welcome to another episode of Nocturnal Emissions. I am hunkered down in my bunker. I've washed my hands. Have you washed your hands? Hopefully you are secluding yourself. You are inside. You are social distancing. You have 6 feet between you and the next person. You haven't made eye contact with anybody in weeks. You haven't felt a human touch in months, and you're slowly going mad from it. I know I am. Anyway, I'm back with some more content. That's right, another podcast episode. Tonight's guest is Matt Baum, who is a gay media historian. He collects, well, I guess he doesn't collect, but he studies and documents queer history and representation in movies, television, and different kinds of media. He has a podcast, a live show, and a YouTube channel, just like your favorite host, just like me. We talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, because if we're going to talk about queer representation in horror movies, we've got to talk about this movie, because y'all, this movie, it's a great conversation. I'm really delighted to talk to Matt. He's a friend of mine, and we have a really great conversation about masculinity, trade, HIV. It's all in there. So another thing is that there might be a mention of some things that are happening with Matt's live show and my live show, which has, as of right now, been canceled for obvious reasons. We were supposed to have shows, both Matt and I, in March, and those got canceled. Not canceled, I will say, postponed. They've been held off until a later period. We're coming back as soon as this is over with. We'll be back with our live shows, God willing, unless something else horrible happens, which you never know nowadays. Anyway, trying to keep it light. So if you just want to check on our social media, check on our Facebook, our Twitters, our Instagrams, we'll keep you guys aware of what's happening. Don't forget that I have a Patreon page as well. So if you like the show and you want to keep it going and you want to help support me in these dark, dark times, please check out my Patreon. It's all in the show notes below. With that, enjoy.
Hello out there. It is I, your humble host, Isabella L. Price, back again with another episode in 2020 of Nocturnal Emissions. Hi, babies. Did you miss me? I know you did. I am back with a very, very, very special, special guest so that we can talk about a very special, special movie that I know you creeps love, 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 love. And I'm so excited to have this, my dear friend, a visionary, an icon, a queer media personality wizard of space and time and queer media and intellect and conversation. Matt Baum is on the podcast. Yay!
Yay! A wizard. I'm so happy to be introduced as a wizard.
I was thinking of, like, you know, you do D&D stuff, so I was thinking, like, okay, wizard, you know, that tracks. I feel like that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have magic powers.
Yes, you do. Matt, thank you for being on the podcast.
Yay! Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited.
Please introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Matt Baum. I do a wide variety of things for the internet. I make a show called Queens of Adventure that features drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. It's a comedy podcast and live show based here in Seattle. You can find that at queensofadventure.com. I also do a podcast called Sewers of Paris. That's queer people talking about the entertainment that's affected their lives. So we have, like, you know, I have a new guest on every week, and we talk about the one piece of media that, like, shaped their life and really go in deep on what it did for them. And I do a lot of YouTube video stuff. I'll take, like, a famous gay episode of some TV show or a movie or something and talk about why it mattered, why it was important, why it was a big deal. So those are kind of my, like, headlining the big ticket items that I do for internet people.
And those are all my favorite things. I love the YouTube series so much because it's really crazy when you go back and you look at shows from, like, the 80s and the 90s when they had, like, gay episodes, you know. There was one episode that you did of, what's it called? All in the Family? What's the one with Archie Bunker?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, which I hated that show when I was a kid, right? Because it's so like, it's like a show that's supposed to be making fun of racist, but like racists love the show. So
yeah, sometimes the humor just like didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. And so I never really, that was not my favorite show. My favorite show was Mama's Family, but a classic, and The Golden Girls, a classic. Mm-hmm. But there's a drag queen on, right? She's like a drag queen, or is that the word they use?
Well, it's funny because terminology was a little more fluid back then, or I don't know, like the meanings hadn't really been settled on. So there's this one episode of All in the Family that has a performer. The character's name is Beverly LaSalle, and she's played by someone who we would today call a drag queen. It was a performer who was based in San Francisco and was kind of famous there. On the show, she uses all these different words to describe herself. She says, I'm a transvestite. I'm a female impersonator. She never calls herself, she never says drag.
Yeah.
And we never see her in like boy mode until like she's been on the show like over the course of 3 years. We never see her like as a boy until the end.
Which is wild.
Yeah. And they use pronouns interchangeably with her. So I don't even know what to call it.
I just like the idea that that show, which is so popular with Republicans, had a character who was like cross-dressing as one mm-hmm. of, for multiple episodes. Mm-hmm. That to me was just, I don't know, like that changed my whole vision of what that show was about. And that's all thanks to you. I mean, going back through episodes of The Golden Girls, I never really realized how progressive The Golden Girls are.
It's wild, yeah.
That show is so ahead of its time. And also those ladies were like horny on Maine. Mm-hmm. And it was like treated like a real thing. I'm just like, of course these women are in their 60s and horny. Like it's not a thing of a deal.
That's
what people do. And I love your series. Please check out my series. It's so, so good. And if you're in the Seattle area, check out one of the live shows. It's like, it's a riot. It's so, so, so much fun. I'm so glad that you can make it onto the show.
Yay.
Honey, you're my first guest of the new year. So
oh, wow. That's exciting.
Yeah. The show that we're going to be talking about today, the movie that we're going to be talking about is Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's mm-hmm. Revenge, which is non-canonically known as the gayest horror movie of its time. Definitely the gayest movie of the Freddy Elm Street universe, and was largely panned when it first came out, and now has a new resurgence as a cult classic horror film of our time. And I'm so glad that we're going to talk about this movie because the movie's iconic. Like, it's an iconic piece of media. I'm going to read real quick the summary of this film. Mm-hmm. Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge is a 1985 American slasher film directed by Jack Sholder and written by David Chaskin. It stars Mac Patton, Kim Myers, Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger, and Robert Roessler. It's the second installment in the A Nightmare on Elm Street film series. The film follows Jesse Walsh, a teenager who begins having reoccurring nightmares about Freddy Krueger after moving into the former home of Nancy Thompson from the first film. Freddy's Revenge was released on November 1st, 1985, and grossed $30 million at the box office on a budget of $3 million. That's huge.
Jeez. Oh my God.
Mixed reviews from critics upon release, with many comparing it unfavorably to its predecessor. However, it has enjoyed later success as a cult classic, with critics having reassessed the film's homoerotic themes and subject material. It was distributed by New Line Cinema, and the film was followed by A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. That's huge.
Right.
10 times. They had a budget of $3 million, and they made $30 million. So this movie is a hit. It's a hit film.
Financially. It reminds me of Blair Witch, which, you know, like a bunch of kids in a camcorder and turned into this giant smash.
Yeah, which happens a lot. Like, the return on investment for horror films is actually gigantic. And so I think that's why people keep making crappy horror films, because you can't afford to make a film that's not so good, because it'll probably make its money back. But this, I mean, $30 million for what, 1985 is huge. For a horror movie, a sequel, you know? Mm-hmm. And I understand that it's not as loved as the first one, and it has a lot of issues with its filming. But the issues that people criticized it for, its queer subtext, is, like, to me, not the real issue, you know?
I think, you know, the story itself, so I have two complaints.
One is, please, let's dive in. Yes.
So overall, we could talk more about, like, the specifics of the movie, but I think, like, the story itself doesn't, like, add up to a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, there's definitely something going on there about, like, sexual anxiety, and I don't think it's ever really, like, addressed or resolved. And the other thing that that kind of bugs me about it is that where it lands is in a place of, like, what basically feels like heteronormativity and a recloseting of the main character.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't love that. I'd like to see, you know, I like my queer villains, and I would have been cool with this being like the new Freddy is like this closeted gay kid is the new Freddy. Like, I think that would have been really a lot more fun than, like, oh, it's okay, the love of a woman will cure you.
I mean, so I'm watching this film and I'm just kind of like, first of all, these two, Jesse and Lisa, have zero sexual whatsoever. It's so painful every single time that they're together. And it just reminds me of, like, I know that this is not like the universal queer experience, but I feel like but most people dated, like, somebody in high school, you know, like, most people kind of were like, no, I'm not, maybe I'm bisexual, you know, like, mm-hmm. we're diving deep and, like, dated somebody of the opposite gender and was like, oh, I am definitely a homosexual. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what that relationship reminded me of that sort of, like, relationship that you have before you make sure that you're like, oh, this isn't it. I don't like it.
Yeah. He's so much closer with his male friend.
Oh my God. Yes. And they have incredible chemistry with each mm-hmm. other. And the whole entire time I was like, oh, I ship this. I ship this relationship so hard.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I have issues with the movie. I feel like, from a writing perspective, it doesn't follow up well with, like, the lore. So you don't really understand what Freddy's motivation is, what his connection is with this kid.
Right. It's like his revenge. Why is his revenge, like, bugging this poor, like, bystander?
Right. Exactly. Like, what exactly is he trying to get revenge for? And Freddy doesn't actually show up that much in the movie. Kind of shows up kind of in the last third of the film to last half of the film. It's mostly Jesse's story. And so it doesn't really feel, honestly, it doesn't even feel like it needed to be a Freddy movie. Mm. It could have been something else entirely. It could have been about, here is this queer kid who is having these nightmares. And is he a killer? Is he not a killer? That to me would have been a much more interesting film.
I wonder if this was a non-Freddy script that was turned into it?
I don't think so. I think they wrote it as a sequel. You know, actually, I can't really remember exactly what the storyline with that whole thing was. I'm pretty sure they wrote it as a sequel. I watched the documentary about the making of this film and all that stuff, and how the writer was talking about how he didn't purposefully put in any of the queer subtext, that's like people putting their own stuff on top of it. And I'm just like,
no, that's just not true.
It's very thinly veiled.
No, this doesn't happen by accident. I mean, even when you're making a movie for $3 million, which is not a lot of resources for something like that, things don't, like, just, whoops, it just happened to happen. I mean, it's like saying The Lost Boys is not supposed to be homoerotic. Whoops, we didn't know. We just put that saxophone guy in those tight pants by accident.
That's so true. I feel like maybe as the writer, as the person, you know, doesn't understand exactly what they're writing, which happens all the time. Our own consciousness kind of leaks out into your own work and stuff like that. But to say that this movie, first of all, there's so many shots of Jesse in his underwear, like full bait and tackle, close-up shots of him in these tiny whiteies.
We get him in a jockstrap too.
We get him in a jockstrap. We have a scene in a bathroom where his coach, who he met at a leather bar.
That whole sequence we've got to talk about. Yeah.
Gets tied up and whipped in a bath in a shower room. Mm-hmm. There's Jesse is like, he has his shirt open the entire time. Like the whole thing is so thinly veiled. And so to me, it feels like the writer subconsciously or otherwise was writing a different movie. And then they were like, well, how does Freddie factor into all of this? And they have to like inject Freddie into this movie. But God, I would have loved to see a movie where it's just like, here's this kid. He's having these lucid dreams. He's trying to hide. There's a part of himself. There's something inside of him that wants to get out, but there's also this man who wants to get in. Like, mm-hmm. It would have been such a better film if we had just leaned into that and not done Freddy at all, in my opinion.
Freddy is so, like, flirty in this movie.
Oh my God, yes.
That line, he's got the line where he's like, you've got the body, I've got the brains.
Yes!
And it's so intimate. And then, like, literally, Freddie is inside Mark's body at one point, Jesse's body at one point.
Yes.
And bursts out, like, out of him, like, oh, is there some subtext here about, like, something that you're holding deep within yourself that you don't want to let out? Hey, I don't know. So much penetration in this movie, too. Oh, my God.
Yeah, like, the part where he comes, where Freddie comes out of him, I was like, okay, put Diana Ross's I'm coming out over it totally fits. Yeah, it's there's so much about coming out and hiding who you are and stuff like that, you know, and hiding your inner feelings. He has these urges, you know, that he can't really explain. And so it's really God. Okay, so backing up, have you seen all of the other Nightmare on Elm Street movies?
This is the only one I've seen.
Great.
Yeah.
Really, you've seen, well, no, I can't even say like you've seen it. Like, you get the point that there's a crazy dude, Freddy Krueger. He was burned to death. You don't get any of this in the second one.
It's no, it's baffling. So my partner has seen it, and he was all the other movies, and he was explaining like, oh yeah, he was like some child murderer or something like that. And so I kind of got a little bit, and you don't really need to know, but it is weird. Like, Who's the sleepy time monster? Right. What are the rules?
Who is this guy in this fedora and this sweater? Like, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, if you're coming in for the second one, it's really confusing. But he was a child murderer. He died in a boiler room. He's a demon now. He comes through dreams. And you have to stay awake in order to not be killed by him, because he can. And if you die in the dream, then you die in real life. And so there's been, oh my God, how many Freddy movies has there been? 8 now? Something ridiculous. I think there's been like 5 major ones. There was one reboot. There was Freddy versus Jason. Mm-hmm. There's been a whole bunch of things. Freddy is a horror icon. She is the moment. She is the she is the future. And Freddy is like a really huge character in horror fandoms. Not my favorite character by far. In the 80s, there was this slasher boom that happened. And so you get Freddy, you get Jason, you get Mike Myers, which I think are like the big three of the horror genre. And Freddy kind of has this sort of queer subtext to them, because Freddy is flirty and will flirt with both female and male characters, this sort of penetrative dream, being inside of oneself. Freddy is an equal opportunity creep. Mm-hmm. And so For better or for worse, Freddie has been very popular with queer audiences. Not my favorite, because I think that Freddie has also been linked together with pedophilia, you know, with being a child predator, which is an old trope that queer people, queer men are child hunters, you know. And so I think that equating Freddie together with that is problematic to me. And I don't necessarily want to make that sort of connection, but I see it. I totally see it. And I totally understand. Here's this character. Unlike Jason or Mike Myers, who are very stoic, you know, kind of machismo silent dudes. Freddie's just like skipping all over town, going in your dreams, you know, wearing dresses, dressing up as your mom, like, you know, laying down in bed with men. Like, I get it, but I don't like it.
So I have a couple thoughts about that. He's sort of like spooky Bugs Bunny in that, he pops up where you don't expect him, and like he can do the cross dressing or whatever. And he's sort of like a troublemaker trickster figure. And I think in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, I knew that he was like a child murderer or abuser or something. And I wasn't really clear on it. And I was like, I don't even need to know about this for this movie. Like, this just isn't a part of what this movie is. He's interested basically in this one kid. And so I take that much more of like, it's just a story of like one obsessive who's going after this like high school student.
Right.
And like the whole thing with like young children, I know that's a part of other movies, but I'm like, this just feels like a reboot. Basically, it feels like an alternate universe version of him where that problematic aspect is not there.
That's so interesting, because what's really unique about this film is two things. One is that it's really a solo dude. And in all the other ones, especially like Dream Warriors, it's like a group of people, mm-hmm. It's a group of kids that are all killed. And really this one is just about Jesse.
It's so personal, yeah.
So personal for just this one character. And of course, in the first one, you have a character who, Nancy Thompson, who kind of comes back up in the series. And that also feels very personal. But it's very unique to have a boy at the center of a film like this. In horror, there's this trope of the final girl, who is the one female who makes it all the way to the end. I have the definition of the final girl. Final girl is a trope in horror films, particularly in slasher films. It refers to the last girl or woman alive to confront the killer. Ostensibly, the one left to tell the story. And Jesse is a final boy. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare that you have one boy in horror films who's left alive at the end of it. Question mark, question mark, question mark. Is he, though? He is like the center of Freddy's attention. There's not a lot of horror movies that have final boys in them.
Yeah, that's really true. And it's another thing that makes him feel... So on looking at this with a little bit more of a critical eye, I wonder if... And I don't think the vocabulary, particularly like the cinematic vocabulary, exists at the time to express this. But it may not be necessarily like homosexuality that is bursting out of him, but maybe just more androgyny.
Okay.
That he is... I wouldn't use the word non-binary to describe him, because he certainly like identifies and presents as just... a guy.
Right.
But I think the character is presented as being insufficiently male,
yes,
for the people around him, and whatever that means in the context of 1980 something. And I wonder if like a remake today, or like just a critical look at it today, would focus more on how he is, you know, sort of blurring the delineation between male and female, in as much as someone could then.
I think that's what audiences really picked up on as well, right? He's not the hero of he's not the strong, strapping hero who, you know, at the end of the movie punches Freddy in the face and stuff like that, you know, and grabs the girl and makes out with her. He gets rescued at the end of the movie by the girl. And he's not, even down to like, the way he screams, he has this very like high-pitched sort of scream in the way that he's treated by his parents, you know, that his father is always like, you know, this kid just needs like a kick in the butt and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, he's not the prototypical male protagonist of the time. I don't even think of today's time. And I think maybe that's why people sort of picked up on this that. And also he's in the role that usually women are in. And he's sort of helpless to Freddy. There is sort of this intimacy between them. Yeah, I think he is a controversial icon because of the fact that he's not your prototypical masculine male protagonist. And that threw people through a loop. And people sort of have a problem with seeing a man who needs to be rescued, you know, or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that might be an issue that audiences, particularly at the time, might have had with this film, that a lady comes to his rescue and it's like, oh, but I want, you know, this is when, not that there's ever not been a time that like macho men weren't like dominating cinema, but like, you know, Rambo movies are coming out and then you've got this like kid who dances funny.
Yes. My favorite part of the whole entire movie. the bar where he pops this like popper and it's like 15 seconds where it's just him and his hips just like, oh my God, it's, the subtext is there. It's thinly veiled. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the era of Stallone, Schwarzenegger, really macho men. And he's not macho. He's very pretty, you know. He's got this super high-pitched scream. He wears these little tiny little briefs. He's really throwing people through a loop. And I keep thinking of like a different movie, like how this movie could be improved. And even today, I don't think that it would have been, that he would have been a very popular character. I think people still would have critiqued him as being too soft or too weak.
Yeah. And, you know, it occurs to me that like, we can't really talk about like queerness in the 80s in cinema without talking about HIV. And so I wonder what might be going on in this movie. I'm speculating here, is that this might be sort of heterosexual expression of HIV stigma, that there's a character who seems just ambiguously androgynous enough that there's a fear of like, oh no, what if the epidemic's coming for me too?
Right.
Because I've interviewed a lot of gay men who grew up in the 80s and 90s, and on Sewers of Paris, often they will talk about how what they thought the future was for them involved a lot of death. And so there were a lot of stories swirling around queer people's heads about what the epidemic meant for their future and how short their future would be. And I have to assume, like, I don't know what heterosexuals do or think, but I have to assume that the straight community, in so much as there is one, had thoughts about that as well. And I wonder if the straight people who were making this movie, this was sort of an expression of like, oh no, HIV is coming for them, for the queers. Are we next? And does any like little show of weakness or softness or femininity, does that make us so queer that like this mystery disease is going to try to, you know, chase us down?
And the first time that Freddy appears to the kids is at this pool party where they've all been like dry humping each other and meeting out and stuff like that. And so that's kind of the first time, if you're going to talk about like HIV coming to the suburbs, you know, that's not an inner city problem anymore. This is something now that's like, what about our children? What, think about our precious Caucasian children, and that they might get this horrific disease from their unbridled sexuality, and that this one kid might introduce that into their community. And that's the fear. You know,
he's sort of the slasher patient zero of the film.
Yeah.
Like he's the one who, like, you know, it's not exactly like he's promiscuous, like in some way, but he's the one whose dreams get away from him and starts infecting the other kids. I don't know if we're reading too much into that, but
I think you're right.
I think, you know, it was so much like, you know, it's unimaginable today how much anxiety and terror there was about HIV around the time. It seems so foreign to the way that we live our lives now.
I just saw this thing on Twitter where this person was being arrested, I think it was the New York City subway or something like that, and he spit at a cop. And so they're trying to find him because he said that he was HIV positive, right? And the way that it was worded was like, loose, out on the streets, here's this person who's HIV positive, and they are a risk because they were spitting on people. And it was like, but you can't get HIV from spitting on a person. That's like, it's 2020. Like, we should all know that you can't get HIV from, but still, it was this huge thing, you know, where people were just like, oh my God, this person should be killed on sight because they're full of saliva. You know, it was like, oh my God, like we're still in ignorance about this whole thing. There's still people who hear HIV and still think death sentence and still think that this person is toxic, you know. Mm-hmm. My theory is, and go with me here, is that Freddie is the personification of Ronald Reagan. All right.
Okay.
Hear me out.
I'm willing to hear you out.
Okay. Freddie notoriously kills Black people, kills kids that are having sex, kills people that are using drugs, and kills queer people. And Freddy Krueger climbs into the nightmares of these young people who are refusing to conform to the ways of their parents, to the norms of their time, and they're doing things that are not aligned with the conservative party, with conservative values. There's this whole trope in horror films where it's like the Black person dies first, the slut dies first. If you're doing the bad kid also dies, you know, like there's all these different kind of things. And the only people that make it out alive are the virgin babysitter, you know, the mom who just loves her child more than anything, the Virgin Maria kind of character. You know, it's those characters that make it out alive. And I feel like Freddy Krueger is Ronald Reagan, because Reagan hated all those people. I mean, Reagan was a boogeyman to a lot of people. Reagan's war on drugs, the HIV crisis, that he just let turn into AIDS, the AIDS crisis, which killed so many, and almost an entire generation of people died because of Reagan's apathy. Ronald Reagan is a boogeyman. You know, speaking personally in Black communities, Reagan was a figure that largely is hated for the way that he terrorized, you know, and you think about how many legends you hear about Reagan putting guns into Black communities, bringing cocaine and crack into Black communities, you know, just to disrupt them, just to destroy those communities. Reagan is a good old-fashioned, nightmare-inducing boogeyman. He's gutting social welfare that's helping poor mothers, you know, who are promiscuous. He's not doing sex ed in school, so, you know, these kids are getting diseases. My theory is, and I do not think anybody intended for this, is that Ronald Reagan literally is Freddy Krueger.
Well, slashers are often very conservative anyway, right? Because they're going after people who are enjoying themselves too much.
Right.
So it's always punishment for having sex or, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing that the thing that I gravitate towards is like the slashers who are like, oh, it's the promiscuous teens who are getting cut up and, you know, they're punished for being sexually active or having some awakening or living the life of their choosing. Someone's coming for them for their being too happy. And so, I don't know, my impression of like slasher monsters is often that they are conservative monsters who are pushing society back towards, you know, conformity. I could be wrong about that because this is definitely not an area where I'm an expert. I'm more of, you know, I know like queer media studies stuff. And so I see often in those contexts, either the monster is something, the monster is the suburbs, basically. Or the monster is just super duper queer. And in those cases, I identify more with the killer or with the monster or with the bad guy, the villain or whatever. You know, I'd much rather be Margaret Hamilton than Dorothy. So yeah, I don't know. I think that in some cases, killers are often more, they just come off as conservative and like protecting traditional values by any deadly means necessary.
No, I think that you're absolutely right about that. This has been a reading. I think that you not being a like horror fan or aficionado actually is very helpful because there's this kind of like circular logic or something that goes into talking to other horror movie fans where it's like we're just repeating the same stuff over and over again. But if you see it, then that's a really valuable kind of thing of being like, oh, okay, then obviously, you know, it's coming through to just regular audiences, just people who are studying the media. And so, which is why I was so excited that you wanted to do the show because you were like, I don't know horror movies. And I was like, perfect. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely a conservative thing. Clive Barker, a very famous queer gay horror movie writer, he often talked about that there were two kinds of forms of horror movies. There's the conservative and the liberal. And the conservative form says that the horror movie, the monster is outside. The monster is an invader. And they're coming into the community to disrupt this, the safety of the community. You know, one of the earliest ones you can think about is Dracula. Dracula is a monster who is this Slavic foreigner who's coming into the community with his money and his unbridled sexuality and his bloodlust in order to disrupt this pure Anglo-Saxon community, right? And then you think about other movies, which are the liberal form of horror movies, which is we are the monster. The monster lives inside of each of us, which are movies like Get Out, or movies like, really Jordan Peele does that really well of being like Us, I think is one of the best ones, or Ari Aster with Midsommar and Hereditary, which is this idea that each and every one of us have the capabilities of becoming a monstrous being or of letting loose the monstrous inside of us. And now currently, more horror films are working with the liberal view of horror versus the conservative view. And I think it's just because of the fact that one, we're moving on progressively in our culture. But I think also because of the fact that there was so much of that in the 80s and it made sense for the time. And now we're looking for new ways of reinventing the horror movie concept. And my fear is not with, even though actually now that I think about it, because I was going to say my fear is not who's outside, my fear is who's inside. But now that I think about it, I think that you could do some conservative horror because we are in this time period where people are afraid of, you know, women who have head veils. You know, the Islamophobia has risen so much. The homophobia, transphobia has risen so much. And so I think there's some room there to kind of revisit conservative horror in the modern context versus liberal horror.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear that. And I think Nightmare, I mean, it seems to me that it falls into maybe a little of each, actually. Yeah.
Totally.
That the monster is part of us. This poor kid, like, Jesse deserves nothing. Like, his family moves to this house. I guess nobody bothered to tell him there were a lot of, like, teen deaths on the street just, like, a year or something earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it falls in the timeline. And this poor kid, like, it's hard for me to really get a sense of what his deal is even. Like, is he a nerd? It doesn't seem like he really has, like, a crowd. Is he a jock? He hangs out with his kid who's a jock, but... just what's his group? What's his clique? I don't know who he is or how he fits in. He feels like a bit of an outsider.
Right. And I think it is a combination of both. It's Jesse's fear of something inside of him coming out. But then it's also the infiltration of Freddy Krueger coming into this community. And everybody around Jesse, like, Jesse is patient zero, and he is sort of infecting, you're at risk the closer you are to Jesse, you know? Mm. Even though he doesn't ever go after his parents, which struck me as odd.
No, I don't think so. I think it's something, this movie's anxiety is about, like, the young generation. And so, like, it's about how the older folks are getting left behind. And when he goes to, like, that leather bar and meets up with his gym teacher, his gym teacher is really no match. His gym teacher is very old fashioned leather, honestly. I mean, let's talk about that scene. So, like, Jesse, what is it? He has, like, a bad dream, right? And then just walks in the rain barefoot to Danny's place or Daddy's place? I can't remember.
I think it is Danny's place, I think. Yeah.
But it really feels like it was supposed to be Daddy's place. Yes. Anyway, so it's this very seedy, gross bar. And, like, he walks in with bare feet. And, like, the whole time I'm like, no bare feet in the bar. Oh, God. But he's in there. And just, like, the most outlandish guy. It's very, like, what a vanilla costume designer would think kinksters wear.
Uh-huh.
So it's, like, I don't know, like, a little bit of leather, a little bit of just, like, punk haircuts. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of, like, 50s nostalgia aesthetic on everyone. Like, it's just, but, like, and red lights everywhere. And everyone just is glowering. And then his gym teacher's there. And then they go back to the school, and his gym teacher, they take a shower, unclear if they messed around or anything, and then the gym teacher gets tied up somehow in the shower and flogged to death with towels?
Yes. Just on the ass, too, which is... Just,
yeah. He's spanked to death.
So, like, we never talk about, A, what is his gym teacher doing there? B, how did they let this underage boy into this club and also order a beer? C, does anybody not notice this adult man in a leather vest take this child to a closed school? There's so many questions in that scene. And it does feel like this is a straight person or somebody from heterosexual culture who is like, this is what I imagine would happen. I imagine that you go to a club, it's a seedy little bar, everybody has, like, too much makeup on, and they're all wearing leather, and they're all listening to Billy Idol, that they're just, that nobody's noticing because they're all just, like, seedy. Also, this suburb that he just has a gay club that he can just walk to. Which suburb is he living in?
Right. And a bar like that.
Seriously. I mean, like, what's going on? Because, I mean, I live in the heart of Seattle, and my local gay establishment is a few ways off. And so I don't feel like, you know, I could walk barefoot in my pajamas to this place. And then, yeah, they just wind up in the showers. He's taking the longest shower ever. And the way that he's watching his coach being spanked to death is, like, so, he's, like, fascinated. He's not repulsed. He's just sort of observing it. And his facial expressions are so fascinating to me because he's not scared. He's not, like, recoiling or anything like that. He's just watching. And then he looks down and he's got Freddy's hand, you know? And it's almost like, oh, like, did he enjoy this? Did he get something out of this? Is there a burgeoning leather daddy inside of Jesse?
Well, I think part of that is like, it feels very much like he's come to, you know, there's a lot of interpretation that can be done with that scene because it's very unclear, like, what's real and, you know, everything's a kind of a hallucinatory vision. But what I was kind of feeling was like that the coach is hypocritical and he's like super like, you know, heterosexual jock mask archetype by day, but by night he's this weird sex pervert, which I think in the vocabulary of the movie means that he is also androgynous in some way, which I would consider a complete misreading of that, what that scene is. Like, it's super oversimplification, but I think what the movie's saying there is that like the coach is himself closeted and he's getting punished for his hypocrisy in presenting in these different ways. And maybe it's some vision of like, Jesse, this is what awaits you. If you keep it bottled up inside, you'll wind up in this world where you're hanging out at this creepy bar and like taking boys home. I honestly, it's very hard to interpret what's actually meant by that sequence.
Right. Yeah. The sequence is really confusing. And it's just, I don't know. This is another time where I feel like the writer was not aware of what they were writing. This is mm-hmm. another time where I feel like the writer is like, I am writing something that I think is like a very straightforward scene. It's a scene of torture and death, supernatural activities. But what's coming across is actually this very, the scene of like, it has this message to it. There's this sort of this message of like, look at what you could be. Like, this is the punishment of mm-hmm. somebody who is a fraud. And it feels like Jesse is punishing this. The way that I took it was that the coach was kind of predatory and was always watching Jesse and was always over Jesse. And okay, so now I feel like I'm reading too much into it. And that Jesse, this coach is a source of sexual anxiety for Jesse. And so Jesse is punishing this person mm-hmm. who is a source of sexual anxiety because of the fact that he gets killed. His friend who escapes my mind, his name is like, it's like Grundy or something like that.
I can't remember. Yeah. Yeah.
Friend's name. He dies. And I feel like those two male characters are sexual anxieties in Jesse that he feels like he has to get rid of mm-hmm. in order to live this quote unquote normal life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about that. And like, return to the normalcy of heterosexuality that he has with his girlfriend. And I just, you know, at the end of the movie, I'm just like, you coward. Be the monster. Come on.
Yeah. And I think that having, because there's really no good, gay, iconic villains, you know, and it's kind of the same line with having black villains as well, in that it's like, okay, gay people in real life have been treated like villains the whole entire time. What does it mean to then have a gay villain in a movie? What mm-hmm. are the implications that you can have when you have a character who is queer to be maligned, to be hated, to be feared, when that already happens in real life? You know, and I think that movies like Us really go into, because for a very long time it's like, how do you have a black villain when black people are feared in real life? Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of question. But I think, how do I think we could do this? I think that having, well, it's the same thing. It's having that person's villainry not be in their sexuality. It's mm-hmm. in their actions, their you know, the way that they do things, who they kill and how. And it doesn't have to be, okay, sidebar, have you seen the BBC Dracula?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Is it the same one as the one that's on Netflix? I can't tell if it's the same. Okay.
Same one. Stephen Moffat, famously of Sherlock and Doctor Who fame. So the movie, to me, is very queer-coded. very, very queer-coded. And many people picked up on that and asked Moffat about that. And he, much like how he denied it for Sherlock, he vehemently denied it for Dracula. And I think that, God, if he had leaned into that, we could have had a perfect queer Dracula. Because there is nothing about his sexuality that is wrong with him. What's wrong with him is his moral failure, and his sexuality is just something that's just kind of, you know, it's his lust. Yes, I did refer to Dracula as a hungry bottom throughout the entire movie. But at the same time, I feel like just having this person be like, okay, well, they're just an insatiable, hungry person, and that they will ruin lives to get it. And it doesn't have to do with the fact that like 75% of his victims in this movie are men, you know? But that's another podcast for another day.
Yeah. I'll have to watch Dracula and come back.
Wait, no, I think you would really like it. I mean, the reading of it, it's very over the top. It, to me, borrows a lot from like Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire. It's very like, oh God, it's so over the top. It's so dramatic. And Dracula is just like a big old queen. You know, the production design is really beautiful. And it's a completely new spin on the tale. So I would love to have you back to talk about that, or to have you back.
Okay.
Talk about something else. I cannot believe that this hour has gone by so fast. But before you go, I just want to ask you really quickly, if you can remember what your earliest experience with horror movies was.
Okay, so there are two movies that really deeply frightened me as a kid, and neither of them are actually horror, but they were for me.
Yes.
One of them was Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Really?
Yeah, I think the unreality of that really threw me. The blending of like real world and toon world and all that stuff. And of course, like Judge Doom at the end is actually legitimately just very scary. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing with like the terror with which toons confront death and the dip. So that one really, really scared me. And the other is E.T.
Yes, same. Oh mm-hmm. my God. Okay, what did E.T. trigger in you?
A couple things. One is just that those kids were so feral. Like they were just on their own so much that it felt like out of control to me. Especially as I recall, there's no dad in the family, right? It's just Elliot and his brother and their mom.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And so I really had no like knowledge, like when I was 5 or 6, I think is when I saw that, and like did not know what it was to have like a non-traditional, non-nuclear family. Yeah. And like that, and that it wasn't commented on, just like filled me with like alarm of like, what's going on? Why is their family like that? So there was that. There was also like the weird mental connection that they had, and the loss of like mental control that Elliot had over his own mind. That really, really scared me. And then there was the invasion of their home when like the scientists come and take over their house. That honestly was probably the scariest part. That's like scared me to death. The like astronauts in the sealed suits violating the sanctity of their safe home. Super scary.
Yeah, I have the same feeling. I also remember seeing it when I was like, had to be under 5. It was so anxiety inducing. Every single part of that film was anxiety. Like there was no, people talk about the movie, like, you know, the part where they're eating Reese's Pieces and the part where Drew Barrymore dresses them up and things like that as being so cute. I don't remember any of that stuff. I remember when E.T. stretches his neck out. I remember when he does the finger thing, which I thought was so strange. And then, yeah, just like these like angry scientists tracking him down, trying to murder him, the entire thing. That movie was so scary for me. And the Roger Rabbit thing is fascinating because it is so like early Uncanny Valley, where mm-hmm. like what is real, what is fake, Oh, and yes, and then the dip thing is so—it's so much a confrontation of mortality. That's fascinating.
I think it was also that Judge Doom was not as he seemed, not as he appeared to be, and that there was something like—I mean, you know, this is again like I think going back to Nightmare Two, something unbridled and unrestrained, like you let your guard down, and it's revealed that there's a monster within. I think Judge Doom, in particular, his loss of control over his steely facade is the moment that it really became horror for me.
Yeah, the part where he like takes his glasses off and his eyes, that part was so like, oh, this is terrifying. This is actually, it turned into a horror movie immediately. That's so funny. I mean, see, my memory is, I love that movie so much. And then my memory of that movie is also that my sister showed me Cool World.
Oh, yeah.
And told me it was a sequel to Roger Rabbit. And I completely believed it. And I don't know if you've seen Cool World in a hot minute, but...
It's been a while, but yeah, that's another one. Like, what is real? Oh, no, it's like that triggers my anxiety too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also, they're both super horny. Yeah, but I love both of those movies. This has been great, Matt. Thank you so much.
Yay. Thank you for having me on.
Oh my God, this was a great conversation. It flew by so fast. I feel like we could talk about this movie for like 18 more hours.
Yes.
You know, and just like, I feel like we barely scratched the surface of everything that's going on with this movie. So Matt, would you recommend this movie?
Absolutely. Yeah. I, you know, as somebody who is not like a real horror person, like this was a pretty accessible movie for me. And knowing that it's part of this like rich canon, I think it's, you know, if you are a horror person, I think it's, you know, an important movie to have digested, but also it has a really unique perspective on what is scary in that time and to that group. I don't think it's a movie without flaws, but I think those flaws are really interesting to talk about.
Okay, cool. All right, Matt, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll be able to talk about more movies soon. You're going to watch Dracula. You're going to get back to me about your feelings about that. Thank you to the audience so much for listening to this very special episode. I'm so glad to be back in 2020. I'm so glad to be interviewing people and talking about horror movies again. This feels so, so, so good. Also, check out, Matt, where can people find you?
Oh, yes. So there's a couple projects that people might like. If you like queer comedy adventure, we've got Queens of Adventure, our podcast featuring drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. They're going on a quest to be heroes, basically. Big, flamboyant, flashy, colorful heroes. So that's at queensofadventure.com. And so there's that. There's also The Sewers of Paris, my podcast where I talk to queer people about the entertainment that changed their lives. So it's a much more intimate one-on-one personal, tell me your whole history kind of conversation. That's at sewersofparis.com. And then if you look on YouTube, my video series there is called Matt Baume's Culture Cruise, where I talk about LGBTQ milestones in books and movies and TV and shows and stuff like that.
Awesome. I'll put all that information in this description of the show so that you can check out Matt's amazing work. Matt, who's like, I mean, like somebody has to be doing this stuff and you're doing all this hard work of like years from now, they're going to be consulting you as the preeminent queer historian of our time. I put that out there. You can catch me, Nocturnal Emissions. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. Please follow me on all those social medias. Get in touch with me. I love hearing about what people think about this show because I have no idea what I'm doing. So I'd love to hear if you like it. Please follow me on Twitter. You can see more of my shit posting and where I'm doing. I also have a website, IsabellaLPrice.com, so you can see all the shows that I do. We'll be back with Nocturnal Emissions live if you're in the Seattle area in March. And our first movie will be Jennifer's Body. Don't quote me on that, but I'm actually really excited about that. We'll be back in March for that. Also, if you're in the Seattle area, I do a live show at the Langston Hughes called Fade to Black, where we focus on Black representation in genre movies. And our next film that we'll be showing is the 90s classic Tales from the Hood. If you haven't seen that movie, it goes so hard. It's still relevant today. It's still one of the scariest movies I've ever seen in my life. So check that out. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I will see you for the next episode. Bye.
That was tonight's episode. Thank you so much to Matt for joining me and talking about Freddy Krueger. I know that that was an absolute treat for myself to hear somebody who has an outsider's perspective to talk about horror movies. It's really actually very interesting to me. Thank you to the audience for listening, and stay safe, stay sane, keep calm, carry on, wash your hands, and stay 6 feet away from each other. And if you live in Georgia, Texas, Florida, go inside. Go the hell inside. What are you doing? The faster you go inside, the faster I can go outside. So I'm going to need you to bunker down. All right, you guys, stay safe. Bye.